Lecture 14, Eliot and the Multiplot Novel.
This will be the first of two lectures on George Eliot. Before proceeding, we need to remember a crucial point. George Eliot is the pseudonym of Mary Ann or Marion Evans, who was born in 1819 and died in 1880. Later in the lecture, we'll talk about Evans's reasons for using a pseudonym. For now, I'll just say that they're very different from Charlotte Bronte's. It's actually rather difficult to generalize about the use of pseudonyms because the circumstances in each case are often completely different. The main purpose of this lecture will be to show how Eliot consolidates the achievements of earlier novelists. We'll see that she's a historical novelist, clearly indebted to Sir Walter Scott. We'll also see that she's a multi-plot novelist who draws on the lessons of Dickens and Thackeray. And finally, we'll identify her as a psychological novelist, heir to the legacy of Jane Austen. In making these points, we'll also consider her moral purposes, examining her distinctive approach to the problem of human egoism or selfishness. And as a moral thinker, she's really unrivaled in the English novel tradition. Let's begin by reviewing the major events of her life. Unlike Dickens or Thackeray, she was born and grew up in the country. She later set her stories there as well. Intensely devout as a young woman, she came to view the Gospels as, quote, histories consisting of mingled truth and fiction, that's her phrase, and decided that she could no longer accompany her father to church. This experience would lead to bitter conflicts with both her father and her brother. It would also make its way into her later writing, especially in her intensely sympathetic accounts of spiritual conflict. After her father's death, she used her inheritance to subsidize a career as a writer and editor, joining the staff of the Westminster Review, one of the leading journals of the day. The Westminster Review had been established in 1824 by James Mill, father of the utilitarian philosopher John Stuart Mill. Unlike its leading competitors, the Westminster Review was progressive, a vehicle for new ideas and emerging writers. During her time on the magazine, she not only worked with the editor, but lived with him and his family. She developed a deep, even passionate emotional attachment to him, but her feelings were not returned. She was also disappointed in her approach to another man, Herbert Spencer, later famous as a popularizer and defender of the theory of evolution. Spencer was so good an argument that he became known as Darwin's bulldog. Perhaps more important to her later fiction, however, was her experience as the translator of two works of biblical scholarship, both originally published in German. The first of these works was The Life of Jesus by David Friedrich Strauss, which she translated in 1846. The second was The Essence of Christianity by Ludwig Feuerbach. This translation appeared in 1854. These two works were among the first in Western history to approach Christianity as a historical phenomenon. In them, she found a way to affirm the teachings of Jesus without accepting the notion of his divinity. She had a brilliant mind, but did not know what kind of writing she wanted to do. Her decision to try her hand at fiction, which she reached in 1857, is itself a sign of the novel's rising status. It's worth noting here that as writers go, Eliot was a very late bloomer. Dickens published his first sketch at the age of 21. She wrote her first story at the age of 37. Her first sketches were submitted anonymously. She began using her pseudonym in 1858 when the sketches were published as a book. One reason for her secrecy was the fact that she was living with a married man, G.H. Lewis. He is the man that she's supposed to have met in the French bookshop. She and Lewis thought of their own relationship as a marriage, but knew that others would disagree. As we think about this relationship, we'll need to understand that Lewis was in some sense a victim of his own generosity. His wife had long been involved with another man, but because he had not immediately sued her for divorce, he had surrendered his right to separate from her legally. He could start a new life with Eliot, and he did, but there was no way for the two of them to get married. The relationship between Eliot and Lewis was loving and productive. Without his steady encouragement, she may never have pressed ahead with her fiction. Lewis died in 1878 after almost 25 years with Eliot. After 18 months, she married another man, John Cross, about 20 years her junior. And she died just a few months after that wedding of kidney disease. Before turning to her fiction, we might note one more thing. Although she later acknowledged authorship of her books, she always wrote and published as George Eliot. Critics continue to use her pseudonym when writing about her work, just as they do in the case of Mark Twain. The business of her name would be complicated in any case. Born Mary Ann, two words, she later changed her first name to Marion. And then later in life, she also asked that friends and acquaintances call her Mrs. Lewis. So if we don't like Eliot, for whatever reason, we have no clear alternative, because every obvious possibility, including Evans and Lewis, seems problematic. Over the course of her literary career, Eliot enjoyed greater and greater success. She gained fame with her very first novel, Adam Bede, which she published in 1859. This story, set in an English village at the end of the 18th century, deals with the consequences of an unwanted pregnancy. The mother of the child, Hetty Sorrell, is contrasted with her cousin, Dinah Morris, a Methodist preacher. Thus, the novel establishes Eliot's great skill in developing women characters, as well as her continuing interest in religious feeling. About a year later, Eliot followed this success with The Mill on the Floss. This novel was in many ways autobiographical, focusing on the vexed yet loving relationship between a brother and sister. The brother, Tom, gets a chance at an education, even though he's not really interested in school. The sister, Maggie, who does want to learn, is deprived of the same opportunity simply because she's a girl. Tom's impulsive and sometimes resentful, while Maggie, though also deeply emotional, can be needy. Tom and Maggie are often at odds, and their relationship is severed in the middle of the novel, and eventually Tom turns Maggie out of the family house. These siblings are reunited only at the very end of the novel, and then only in death as Maggie tries and fails to save Tom from a flood. The deaths of Tom and Maggie give the novel a tragic dimension, marking it as one of the few tragic novels produced in this period. After writing three more books, Eliot turned her attention to Middlemarch, the novel widely regarded as her masterpiece. By the time she finished it, in December of 1872, she stood alone among English novelists. The great novelists of the early Victorian period, including Dickens, Thackeray, and both Charlotte and Emily Bronte, were all dead. New writers, like Thomas Hardy and Henry James, were entering the scene, but they had not yet been identified as major figures. In many ways, Eliot had the field all to herself, her only serious rival being Anthony Trollope. Eliot's triumph was not merely a matter of historical accident. In Middlemarch, her account of life in and around a small country town, and Middlemarch is a place, the name of this town, she synthesized earlier achievements in the novel form. Middlemarch is indebted to the historical fiction of Sir Walter Scott. In Eliot's novel, as in work like Scott's Waverley, we see how individuals are affected by larger historical forces. Eliot places her fictional community on the brink of change, setting the story in the period surrounding the Reform Bill of 1832. Now, in speaking about Barnaby Rudge, Dickens' first attempt at a historical novel, I said that he chose an unpromising subject. In speaking about Middlemarch, I want to say just the opposite, for the period leading up to the passage of the bill is a splendid choice. As many historians have noted, the bill represents Britain's final acceptance of democracy and modernity. The old landed interests, the elites who had controlled the nation's political institutions for so long, would now have to share power with the rising middle classes. The bill didn't extend voting rights to everyone, as the Chartists and others would later point out, but it took a definite step in the direction of universal suffrage. With the bill in place, it was only a matter of time before further extensions of the franchise would occur. Eliot's characters not only debate the bill, but also witness the extension of railway lines into their parish. Here, too, her choice and treatment of historical materials is impeccable. What she shows us, first of all, is that society is resistant to change. In the area to which Middlemarch belonged, her narrator explains, railways were as exciting a topic as the Reform Bill or the imminent horrors of cholera, and those who held the most decided views on the subject were women and landholders. Women both old and young regarded traveling by steam as presumptuous and dangerous and argued against it by saying that nothing could induce them to get into a railway carriage, while proprietors were unanimous in the opinion that these pernicious agencies must be made to pay a very high price to landowners for permission to injure mankind. Eliot helps us to see how the fear of change can be stirred up and exploited. Later, one of the landowners tells a wagoner named Hiram Ford that the railroad men mean to do harm to the land and the poor man, adding that in other parts of the country, the folks fell on the railroad men when they were spying and drove them away, so as they knew better than come again. It isn't long before Hiram and six or seven of his friends are making an offensive approach, hayforks in their hands, against some agents from the railroad company. The fight doesn't quite come off in the end, but for a moment, there's a real threat of violence. Eventually, one of Eliot's favorite characters, Caleb Garth, goes to talk with the rural workman. Caleb speaks both firmly and compassionately. He's an agent for several local estates, and he's also one of the men who helped to break up the fight. Instead of simply scolding the workmen, Caleb talks sense to them, crediting them with good motives and the wish to be reasonable. "Now, my lads," he says, "you can't hinder the railroad. It will be made whether you like it or not, and if you go fighting against it, you'll get yourselves into trouble. The law gives those men leave to come here on the land. The owner has nothing to say against it, and if you meddle with them, you'll have to do with the constable and Justice Blakesley, and with the handcuffs and Middlemarch jail, and you might be in for it now if anybody informed against you." "But come, you didn't mean any harm," Caleb says later, correctly guessing at what must have happened. "Somebody told you the railroad was a bad thing. That was a lie. It may do a bit of harm here and there, to this or to that, and so does the sun in heaven. But the railway's a good thing." When Caleb is challenged by the oldest of the men, reminded that the railway is mostly good for the big folks to make money out on, he refuses to rise to the bait, continuing reasonably. "Things may be bad for the poor man, bad they are," he says, "but I want the lads here not to do what will make things worse for themselves." Eliot thinks that Caleb is right, but she wants him and wants us to see things from the workman's point of view as well. Resistance to change is futile, yet understandable. The workmen have no reason to believe Caleb when he insists that the railroad will be good for everyone. As he realizes, and more or less admits, they will be the last to reap its benefits. So, like Scott, Eliot asks us to consider what's gained and lost in the process of historical transformation. As we do when we're reading any great historical novel, we know what the characters cannot know, that their way of life is about to disappear, as their small town will soon be absorbed into a much larger social network. And we owe it to those characters not to oversimplify the matter. All right, then. In addition to adapting the historical novel, Eliot may have perfected the form of the multiplot novel, extending the achievements of other Victorian writers. Like Dickens, here we might think of Bleak House, she begins with several distinct groups or clusters of characters. One group, reminiscent of the gentry families in Austen, lives in or around a manor house called Tipton Grange. At the center of this group is Dorothea Brooke, a pious young woman who surprises us with her sudden decision to marry Edward Casaubon, a middle-aged clergyman and scholar. Another group includes characters living in the town of Middlemarch itself, and they include the mayor, his son and daughter, and a young physician, Tertius Lydgate, who has recently arrived to work at a new hospital. We now know that these stories were originally conceived as separate writing projects and were not combined until Eliot had made substantial progress on both of them. In addition to these two character clusters, Eliot introduces a third major grouping, which includes childhood sweethearts Fred Vincey and Mary Garth. Given those circumstances, it's especially impressive that the transitions between the plots are nearly seamless. Unlike Dickens, who often relies on dramatic juxtapositions, Eliot prefers a smoother approach. In Chapter 10, for example, there's a party at the Grange attended by both Dorothea and Lydgate, the doctor. Eliot's narrator follows Lydgate home, telling us of his thoughts, and with that makes the shift from country to town. In later chapters, Eliot continues to use Lydgate in this way. Because he's a physician, he has occasion to visit the homes of many other characters, so she can use him kind of as an entree into these other characters and their lives. By the end, Eliot has connected all of the characters in the book, demonstrating what her narrator calls the stealthy convergence of human lots. The novel's three major plots, sharply distinct at the outset of the story, have merged by the end. You can't tell them apart by the end. Behind this narrative design lies a crucial moral purpose: to move us out of our habitual egoism. If we can understand our connections to other people, Eliot reasons, we may be less likely to behave selfishly. We are all of us born in moral stupidity, the narrator says at one point, taking the world as an udder to feed our supreme selves. That image is arresting. It suggests that we can't see the world as anything more, anything other than a source of food for ourselves. Like an infant, we take and take greedily, never considering the possibility of giving something back. Eliot often uses such images as vehicles for the delivery of a moral message. In one of the most famous examples, an example I'd like to treat at some length, taken from the start of chapter 29, she sets up an even more elaborate analogy, likening the world to a scratched pier glass. And here I might just explain that a pier glass is a kind of mirror. An eminent philosopher among my friends, the narrator says, who can dignify even your ugly furniture by lifting it into the serene light of science, has shown me this pregnant little fact. Your pier glass, or extensive surface of polished steel made to be rubbed by a housemaid, will be minutely and multitudinously scratched in all directions. But place now against it a lighted candle as a center of illumination, and lo, the scratches will all seem to arrange themselves in a fine series of concentric circles around that little sun. It is demonstrable that the scratches are going everywhere impartially, and that it is only your candle which produces the flattering illusion of a concentric arrangement, its light falling with an exclusive optical selection. Let's pause there. The narrator's philosophical, scientific friend has pointed out this strange fact, this strange phenomenon, and it's one that you may have noticed for yourself. If you hold a candle or a match up to something shiny, like a mirror or a silver serving dish, scratches on the surface of the object will appear to arrange themselves in a pattern, forming concentric circles around the reflection of the light. That pattern isn't really there. The scratches actually go every which way. But for that moment, it appears to be. These things are a parable, the narrator concludes. The scratches are events, and the candle is the egoism of any person now absent. Like all parables, perhaps, this one proves difficult to interpret, or at least tricky. Now, I suppose you might say that at first the meaning looks obvious. We all think that we're at the center of the universe, assuming that everything in it revolves around us. That's true enough, but on closer inspection, other possibilities begin to emerge, including one that complicates the situation considerably. Remember that the candle doesn't mean to create that optical illusion. The illusion is something that just happens without anyone's intervention. Now, if the analogy holds, perhaps we can no more avoid placing ourselves at the center of the universe, thinking of ourselves in that way, than the candle can avoid causing or creating the optical illusion. In that case, we can't reform our behavior in any easy or obvious way. We can't prevent ourselves from being egoistic, to use Eliot's term. What we can do is be aware of the role of egoism in our lives and try to make that awareness the basis for our actions and our judgments. In addition to following in the footsteps of Scott, Dickens, and Thackeray, Eliot also takes after Jane Austen. Along with her other accomplishments, Eliot is a distinguished psychological novelist, one of the best and most important in the history of English fiction. Eliot is eager to explore previously neglected experiences and emotions. She wants to populate her world with new sorts of characters. Among the most striking examples of these new characters in Middlemarch is Dorothea Brooke. As Eliot introduces the character, we can't help but see a faint resemblance between Dorothea and Austen's Emma. Dorothea is a little younger than Emma, just 19 instead of 21. She's an orphan, but she's already got a secure place in society. Indeed, like Emma, she's rich and well-connected. Finally, she's also beautiful and intelligent. Yet whereas Emma is happy to stay within the confines of her immediate social world, she never thinks about venturing off to London, going off to school, learning new languages. Dorothea wants something more. In the opening pages of the novel, before the introduction of Dorothea, Eliot's narrator offers a few words about St. Teresa, an important figure in the tradition of Christian mysticism, as well as the founder of a religious order. The narrator explains that Teresa's passionate ideal nature demanded an epic life. Teresa was certainly not the last of her kind, the narrator adds. Many Teresas have been born who found for themselves no epic life wherein there was a constant unfolding of far resonant action. Perhaps only a life of mistakes, a life of mistakes, the offspring of a certain spiritual grandeur, ill-matched with the meanness of opportunity. Once we meet Dorothea, we immediately realize that she is one of these later-born Teresas. Her mind was theoretic, the narrator explains in the opening pages, and yearned by its nature after some lofty conception of the world which might frankly include the parish of Tipton and her own rule of conduct there. She was enamored of intensity and greatness, the narrator adds, and rash in embracing whatever seemed to her to have those aspects. Here, we have definitely come a long way from Emma. Whatever else you might say on Emma's behalf, you'd never claim that she yearns after some lofty conception of the world or is enamored of intensity and greatness. Dorothea's intellectual and spiritual yearnings make her something of a misfit. Despite her beauty and wealth, she doesn't quite fit in. And that's another difference from Emma, who is always at the center of things in Highbury. In a memorable scene at the end of the opening chapter, Dorothea is contrasted with her younger sister, Celia. Celia is also smart and pretty, but she's entirely practical, very much a person of this world. The scene begins when Celia asks Dorothea to help her divide up their mother's jewels. "It is exactly 6 months today since Uncle gave them to you," Celia says, "and you have not looked at them yet." So we get the impression that Celia has wanted to divide up the jewels for a while and is kind of held back out of some deference to Dorothea. Dorothea agrees to look at the jewels, but not without first reminding her sister, gently, that we should never wear them, you know. So here again we have a sort of sign of her spiritual superiority. One of the first pieces taken from the box is a pearl cross with 5 brilliants in it. Dorothea thinks Celia should have it to wear with her dark dresses, but Celia suggests that Dorothea keep it for herself. "Not for the world, not for the world," Dorothea replies. "A cross is the last thing I would wear as a trinket," she says, shuddering. Dorothea's words and her body language make Celia uneasy. She loves and admires her sister, but also wonders about Dorothea's usual air of spiritual superiority. "Will you then think it wicked of me to wear the cross?" she asks. "No, dear, no," says Dorothea, stroking her sister's cheek. "Souls have complexions too. What suits one will not suit another." The affection between the sisters is obvious, but so are the contradictions in Dorothea. She does give off an air of superiority. She does make her sister feel shallow and materialistic, even though she doesn't really mean to. As the scene plays out, the narrator is careful to show us that Dorothea appreciates the beauty of the gems. "It is strange how deeply colors seem to penetrate one, like scent," she says at one point. And near the end of the scene, she agrees to keep a few pieces for herself. In pursuing spiritual perfection, the narrator suggests in this opening chapter, Dorothea is denying her own nature. Unlike most severely religious people of the time, perhaps, She is not really indifferent to the things of this world. She loves the beautiful colors of the jewels and enjoys physical exercise too. In an earlier passage, we've been told that she delights in horseback riding. She loved the fresh air and the various aspects of the country, the narrator has said, and when her eyes and cheeks glowed with mingled pleasure, she looked very little like a religious devotee. Riding was an indulgence which she allowed herself in spite of conscientious qualms. She felt that she enjoyed it in a pagan, sensuous way, and always looked forward to renouncing it. My students are often drawn to this passage. Indeed, they're usually critical of Dorothea for pretending she's immune to physical and sensual pleasure. Sister Celia's pet name for Dorothea is Dodo, and my students often see Dorothea, at least at first, as something of a dodo. As I say, they're right, at least partly right. Like the characters in the book, the students are slightly bewildered by a person who could be another Emma Woodhouse, could be the most popular girl in town, but chooses instead to dress plainly, here's a nice quotation from that first chapter, to kneel suddenly down on a brick floor by the side of a sick laborer and pray fervently as if she thought herself living in the time of the apostles. Dorothea's yearnings and her lack of self-understanding do get her into trouble, very serious trouble. She chooses to marry Mr. Casaubon because she thinks it will be like marrying Pascal or John Milton. The really delightful marriage must be that where your husband was a sort of father, she thinks at one point, and could teach you even Hebrew if you wished it. Casaubon is not cut out for marriage, as we'll see in our next lecture, and neither at this point in her life is Dorothea. Nevertheless, as students eventually discover, we can't blame Dorothea for looking beyond Middlemarch. Given her gifts and her aspirations, she shouldn't have to settle for the sort of unimaginative man her guardian or her friends might have picked out for her. She deserves something better than that. By the end of the novel, Dorothea has found something better. Freed from her first marriage by Mr. Casaubon's death, she's now able to marry for love, and does so in spite of her friends' and family's disapproval. At the very end of the novel, there's another scene between Dodo and Celia, a pendant to that first one with the jewels, and it helps to show us that Dorothea is finally ready to accept her own desires and act on her own behalf. Dorothea's second husband is Will Ladislaw, distant younger cousin to Casaubon. After their marriage, the two of them move to London, where he eventually gains a seat in Parliament, and she is, the narrator explains, only known in a certain circle as a wife and mother. Dorothea has not become another St. Teresa, but that doesn't seem to matter. Not to her, and not to the narrator, who closes the novel with these two striking paragraphs. "There is no creature," she says, "there is no creature whose inward being is so strong that it is not greatly determined by what lies outside it. A new Teresa will hardly have the opportunity of reforming a conventual life any more than a new Antigone will spend her heroic piety in daring all for the sake of a brother's burial. The medium in which their ardent deeds took shape is forever gone. But we insignificant people, with our daily words and acts, are preparing the lives of many Dorotheas, some of which may present a far sadder sacrifice than that of the Dorothea whose story we know. Her finely touched spirit had still its fine issues, though they were not widely visible. Her full nature, like that river of which Cyrus broke the strength, spent itself in channels which had no great name on the earth. But the effect of her being on those around her was incalculably diffusive. For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs." Now, in closing this lecture, I need to make a very important point, which is that characters like Dorothea, characters with these spiritual and intellectual desires, had never before appeared in English fiction. By placing such characters at the center of her novels Eliot takes the form in a new direction, investing it with an unprecedented sense of moral and intellectual seriousness. In our next lecture, we'll continue our discussion of Eliot's Middlemarch, examining her treatment of three more fascinating characters: Dr. Lydgate, Mr. Casaubon, and Nicholas Bulstrode.